Welcome to Good Evening, the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me today, as always, is my good friend, the foreign correspondent, Chris Haig. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing, man?
I am doing just excellent. I just came back from church, and we had a pie-eating contest, and I'm doing good, but I don't feel so good in the belly. This year's pie was key lime pie, and it was really sweet.
I was going to ask, I was like, what kind of pie? What did you do?
Last year's was pumpkin, and I won. This year, I didn't win. It was a close call, though. They had judges out.
Oh, my God. Well, if you hear any noises, then it's just clearly Brandon's stomach just going like, oh, my God, how much pie did we eat?
I ate too much pie, yes. Unfortunately, Tom is not able to join us today. There's a reason. We've got a big, interesting, crazy, conflicting schedule here because we had a lot of time zones that we have to coordinate because we do have two special guests. Now, Tom does have a segment that we will be inserting later on in the show, and I believe he messaged us the other day and said he's going to be talking about staircases and steps in Hitchcock as part of his little intro or insert that we'll be putting in later on. But joining us is returning guest David Cairns, all the way from the Scottish Highlands himself. How's it going, David?
I guess I'm good. I guess it's where the Midlands where I'm from. But yeah, we're 39 steps territory. I'll be able to talk about the locations a little bit.
Excellent, right on. Yeah, and you you are a big fan of this film, and some history for the listeners of the show. So you were on for our episode on blackmail.
Yeah,
and you let us know. You said, I'd love to talk about this one here. And so if anybody has the Criterion Blu-ray release, David wrote the liner notes for this, for the Criterion Blu-ray. So he knows a little bit about this film. You know he kind of knows what he's talking about.
Hopefully. So. Although it's been a while, so my memory may be rusty. But hopefully I can recall something.
Yes, we've probably all seen it a million and a half times too. So, yeah. But joining us all the way... Haven't seen her, haven't heard her voice on this since way back on episode 2. This is episode 26. We had one of our podcasting pals submit some answers to the questions that I submitted to a few different people. Is friend of the show, Alice Baker. How are you doing, Alice?
I'm doing good out here in actually cool Arizona, which is, you know, a rare thing to say. So I'm doing pretty good. The weather here is awesome right now.
Is it? What do you got for a temperature down there today?
Oh my gosh, maybe 74?
74, right on. It's nice here too. Yeah, we're at about Fahrenheit, I'd say we're probably at about 32.
Oh, nice.
Which is good for this time of year.
right, sure.
That's 0 Celsius, Chris. We're right at 0 right
okay.
now.
Okay, I was going to say, I was there just like Fahrenheit, and I'm like, I'm crap at math, so I can't work it out backwards. I was like... Because it's all Celsius here, I know.
Right.
Excellent, right on. Well, Alice, yeah, so we had you answer a few questions way back on episode 2, but I'll probably ask you a couple of them. We're going to get a little bit of your history with Hitchcock. Tell us about your love of Hitchcock and some of your favorite films and how you discovered him and what you think of him and his work.
Gosh, how did I discover Hitchcock? What an interesting question. I probably, like many people, you know, his films are so famous. He's such a famous director. Before I even became interested in film, I probably had seen them without really understanding who he was and sort of the impact he and his films had made sort of on the industry and, you know, frankly, pop culture on the whole. And then probably late high school and then into college, I became more serious film student, although never a super, you know, I don't have a degree in film or anything like that. I just have always enjoyed film. So I took classes. And when you take classes in film, you're going to learn about Alfred Hitchcock. although now that I think of it, I remember growing up and watching the television series. What was that called?
Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Yes, I remember watching that growing up. So I think probably for a long time, I really only knew the big films that everybody knows, Psycho, The Birds, Rear Window, the big ones. And then I sort of came across the 39 Steps without really realizing it, that it was an Alfred Hitchcock film, to be honest. It sort of came in the middle when somebody was watching it and fell in love with it. And was like, oh, that's so fun. That's just such a great film. It's very clever and, you know, old-timey, but in a good way. And I can see all of these great plot turns and chases and things like that. And I just really enjoyed it and thought it was so fun and clever. And it wasn't until probably the third time I saw the film that it really clicked to me that it was an Alfred Hitchcock film. Okay. And I was like, wow, okay. Maybe I can make some connections here and see sort of how his style that everybody knows sort of grew out of this film. But it's just such a fun film. And it doesn't get old. I've watched it, as you said, many, many times. Yeah, I just really enjoy it. And I came to really like his earlier work, you know, Sabotage and some of his earlier black and white stuff and really falling in love with it.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Right on. Well, that's wonderful. That's great. I'm really glad you love this movie so much. And you'd mentioned back in the episode 2 that you love this one. So I wanted to reach out to you for this one and have you on as a guest. So. I messaged Chris today. I'm like, this is the 17 out of 52 because there's the one that we can't watch, yes. Right? But we're 17 out of 52. We're a third of the way through his career here. So again, if anybody's listening, they got that copy of Mountain Eagle anywhere, you know, let us know. We'd like to see it. You know, I'm sure the British Institute would like to have a copy as well.
I know. But... I mean, I think they'd like to give us a copy. If they find it, the first port of call will be, listen, there's a podcast
first people,
that needs this.
Yeah.
I mean, why they wouldn't, I don't know, but yeah.
Excellent. Right on. Well, Chris, why don't you give us a quick little summary of the film?
I will, and it is a very quick summary, because there is a much longer one, but I'd much rather we get into kind of the deeper discussion. So, while attending a music hall performance in London, Richard Hannay, Robert Donat, becomes embroiled in an international spy ring related to the mysterious 39 Steps. Then he meets Agent Annabella Smith, Lucy Mannheim, who is soon killed in his apartment. He must elude the police, who are hunting him for murder, while he tries to stop Professor Jordan, Godfrey Till, from sending secrets out of the country. Hannay is assisted by Pamela, played by Madeline Carroll, an unwilling accomplice who discovers the truth.
Hi, this is Tom Caldwell. Today I want to talk to you about Alfred Hitchcock and his use of staircases in his movies. Hitchcock has a lot of recurring visuals he likes to use, many of which we've talked about before on the podcast, such as brandy or cognac, knives, guns, and his tendency to have deaths or murders happen off-screen. All of these things serve some purpose. Having a character serve brandy to another person usually sets up a comfortable conversation, a relaxed encounter, an open dialogue. The use of kitchen knives as murder weapons speaks to crimes of passion. People who are caught up in a moment and act quickly without premeditation to use the closest weapon they can find. Hitchcock knew that the viewer's imagination can invent a much more horrifying murder than he could ever create on camera, and tended to let killing happen out of frame, in the next room, or behind some barrier. Why did he use staircases so much? What purpose do they serve? The primary function of stairs is to move people from one level to another. There are barriers as well as portals. They can bring opportunity or peril. In Hitchcock's silent gem, The Lodger from 1927, the lodger lives upstairs, and much time is spent by the boarding house owners wondering what he is up to up there. Psycho features a lot of staircases. There is the long climb up to the Bates house, a progression towards this evil place. The house looms high, looking down at the motel, much like Mother watches over Norman. Arbogast enters the home and walks tentatively up the stairs, unsure of what he will find, only to be stabbed at the top and to fall oh so tragically to his death at the bottom of the stairs. Another staircase in the Bates house leads down into the disturbed depths of the basement, where Mother's corpse is revealed, The Mummy Mummified. In Shadow of a Doubt, Uncle Charlie stays in the bedroom on the second floor. He uses the front staircase openly, does his sneaking about via the rear stairs out the back of the house. He tries to kill young Charlie by cutting a step to make her fall. But later on, Uncle Charlie comes down the stairs wearing the incriminating ring. Vertigo prominently features a bell tower stairway. In 39 Steps, Pamela stands at the top of a stairway and hears that Richard is telling the truth. And who could ever ignore the glowing glass of poisoned milk making its way up the stairs in suspicion? Hitchcock's stairways are many different things at many different times. They can be grand, plain, domestic, industrial, rickety, curved, straight, ornate, dark, easily ascended, or anxiously explored. Some are used by mobs of conformist working men and others by light-footed dancing girls. This everyday item, the staircase, is not used by chance in his films. More often the staircases we see are there for a purpose. They help to tell a story, to make Hitchcock's films better than they already were. Reporting for Good Evening, this is Tom Caldwell.
Excellent.
Very
and
intriguing.
We will jump into some of the behind-the-scenes information, some of the facts on the film, and everything here has been taken from either Hitchcock Zone or Wikipedia on the film. So let's jump into the facts here. The 39 Steps, it's a 1935 British film, and it stars Robert Donat and Madeline Carroll. It's loosely based on the 1950 novel of the same name by, I hope I'm saying this right, John Buchan? Is it Buchan or Buchan? Yeah. Buchan. Okay, excellent. Right on. The British Film Institute has ranked this the fourth best British film of the 20th century. And, you know, when you're getting up that high, you're splitting hairs, I think, to like give something a ranking. 2004, Total Film named it the 21st greatest British film ever made. So I'm guessing that those 4 years must have had some really great films for them to have such a difference in their rankings. 2011 ranked the second best book-to-film adaptation of all time, and filmmaker and actor Orson Welles has referred to this film as a masterpiece. The release dates on Wikipedia are listed as June 6, 1935 in London, and August 2, 1935 in the U.S. Now, several sources claim that production on this film was held up by C.M. Wolfe, who felt that the film was too highbrow, and he tried to push Hitchcock and Bennett into actually developing a musical based on Floridora, which I don't know that. Do you guys know what that is? Is that a stage play?
Floridora?
No idea.
I just can't picture Hitchcock doing a musical. I know that they kind of describe Waltzes from Vienna as a musical, but I wouldn't really classify that as a musical myself.
Yeah. I just wouldn't think of this film, even in its current state, as highbrow.
Yeah, I know. But C.M. Wolfe was kind of pushing, he was kind of a barrier to Hitchcock a couple of times in the past as well. I know that his name came up as well on the 39 Steps research that I did, so he might have just not liked him.
I think Hitchcock had a fair bit of trouble with the studios at this time, and had been struggling to, you know, make the films that he wanted to make. And several of the films before this are films that he didn't particularly want to make, as far as we can tell. Mm-hmm.
The production company, Gaumont British, was eager to establish its films in the international markets, especially in the United States. 39 Steps was conceived as a prime vehicle towards this end. Where Hitchcock's previous film, The Man Who Knew Too Much, had cost £40,000, the 39 Steps cost nearly £60,000. Much of the extra money went to the star salaries for Robert Donat and Madeline Carroll, both of which who had already made films in Hollywood, and they were therefore known to American audiences. And British cinema didn't have very many international stars at the time, so this was considered very, very vital to the film's success. Now, I did a little bit of inflation calculations, and £60,000 from 1936 would be $4.12 million as of today, which converts to about $5.2 million U.S. dollars. And I tried to look up and see what, like, an average budget of a movie was, but all that I could find were lists of like most expensive films. So I don't know how high $5 million would be in a film today. Like, is that really low or is that really high or what?
That's quite low.
Is it?
For the UK, it's kind of, it would be medium high.
Okay.
It, you know, compared to a Hollywood movie, that for a Hollywood movie, that would be considered not much at all.
Mm-hmm.
In the UK, you're doing quite well if you've got 5 million.
Yeah. Yeah. So 4 million pounds is the conversion to today. So that did seem low because some of them were like, that I saw in there were, what are the Pirates of the Caribbean is like 500 million or something. I don't know. I don't remember exactly the numbers, but it was significantly higher. So, scholar Mark Glancy has noted that Hitchcock had some strange on-set behavior for this film. He started with mentioning things like smashing teacups and studio lamp bulbs, and he was also calling his film stars Mr. Donut and the Birmingham Tart. So, and he did this, as, and it was designed to exert his authority and preeminence over the actors. And it's been guessed that this was due to Hitchcock witnessing this kind of behavior from some German directors, and they would implore similar techniques to prick the actors' egos. But I'm not sure that this would fly in this day and age to be like outright, you know, calling your actors' names while you're filming. That probably not something that would continue.
Nope.
The 39 Steps is the second film after The Lodger in a line of Hitchcock films based upon an innocent man being forced on the run, which would go on to include Saboteur and North by Northwest, which I'm sure North by Northwest is going to come up a couple of times in this discussion today. It contains another Hitchcock trope of the MacGuffin. Now, I got to say, while we're I need you guys to remind me when we get to the MacGuffin. I got to tell you about my wife's take on the MacGuffin, because my wife and I actually watched this movie together, and it was actually quite interesting, her opinion on the MacGuffin. Hitchcock's cameo takes place at about 6.5 minutes into the film, and both Hitchcock and screenwriter Charles Bennett can be seen walking past a bus that Robert Donut and Lucy Mannheim board outside the music hall. Hitchcock is also seen briefly as a member of the audience scrambling to leave the music hall after the shot is fired in the opening scene. The film established the quintessential Hitchcock blonde with Madeline Carolyn as the template. So this would be a trope that he would use continuously for the rest of his career. And the female characters in his films reflected the same qualities over and over again. They were blonde, they were icy and remote, they were imprisoned in costumes that subtly combined fashion with fetishism. They mesmerized the men, who often had physical or psychological handicaps. And sooner or later, every Hitchcock woman was humiliated. And this was written by Roger Ebert. So, keeping with many Hitchcock films, key sequences are shot in familiar locations. King's Cross Station, Piccadilly Station, and the dramatic sequence on the Fourth Bridge were some of the ones that we saw in this film. Now, a bit on the actors before we finish up. Frederick Donat was an English film and stage actor. He's best remembered for his roles in this film, as well as Goodbye, Mr. Chips, for which he won the Academy Award for Best Actor. Donat made his first stage appearance in 1921 and his film debut in 1932 in The Private Life of Henry VIII under the renowned film director and producer Alexander Korda. In his book, The Age of the Dream Palace, Jeffrey Richards wrote that Donat was the British cinema's one undisputed romantic leading man of the 30s. The image he projected was that of a romantic idealist, often with a dash of the gentleman adventurer. Donat suffered from chronic asthma, which affected his career and limited to him appearing in only 20 films, and this was his only Hitchcock appearance. Edith Carroll was an English actress, popular in both Britain and America in the 30s and 40s, and at the peak of her success, she was the highest paid actress in the world. She earned a staggering $250,000 in 1938. Following a move to London, she became a stage actress in 1927 and quickly moved into films, taking a role in The Guns of Lewes. By the end of 1928, she'd starred alongside Miles Mander in The Firstborn, written by Alma Revel, and who had become acquainted with Revel's husband, Alfred Hitchcock. Carol is remembered for her role in The 39 Steps, and she's also noted for abandoning her acting career after the death of her sister Margaret in the London Blitz. And she devoted herself to helping the wounded servicemen and children displaced and maimed by war after that. We'll see her again in Secret Agent, and she also performed in the radio adaptation of The 39 Steps for the CBS Philip Morris Playhouse. Let us jump into our discussion. So, I'll start with, because I don't want to forget it, I want to talk about the MacGuffin, and I want to tell you, because my wife had a really interesting take on this. She was really upset about not knowing what the MacGuffin was. And I explained to her, I'm like, but that's what the MacGuffin is. I mean, like, the MacGuffin is just something that's important to the people in the film and it advances the plot, but it really doesn't matter what it is. And I used the example of something, the most modern MacGuffin that I can think of is the suitcase in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what's in there, right? It's just, this is what's advancing the plot of the story. It doesn't matter what it is, right? Because it's not about what's in the suitcase. It's about the plot. It's about the characters, and this is about the man on the run. So I'd like to talk for a little bit about the MacGuffin itself, because this is a prime thing that Hitchcock has used over and over in his films. David, why don't we start with you on the MacGuffin?
Yeah, is this, would I be right in saying that The 39 Steps is maybe the first MacGuffin?
We had it kind of in The Man Who Knew Too Much as well.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You know, but which was the one just before this one here. So I think The Man Who Knew Too Much, although I think most people do associate it with this film more. Now, because I've watched so many movies over the last little bit, I can't remember what the MacGuffin was in The 39 Steps, but there was,
it's the words, The 39 Steps.
Really, or, sorry, not The 39 Steps. I meant The Man Who Knew Too Much. I can't remember what it was in The Man Who Knew Too Much, which was...
Yeah.
Would it be the guy they've got to assassinate?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they're after.
It's like, why they've got to kill this diplomat.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we don't care. It doesn't matter. But it's a little bit... To have a human MacGuffin makes it a little bit more human. In a way, that one is verging. Yeah, it's semi MacGuffin, and this one is the most total MacGuffin because it's so abstract. Just the 39 Steps is a network of spies. It turns out to be something that's not even really in the film.
I'm sorry. No, I was just gonna say I don't interpret the MacGuffin to be the 39 Steps. I interpret the MacGuffin to be Mr. Memory and the secret that he holds.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing about the plane.
Yes.
Right. That's that's the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess so. Although the secret that he holds turns out to be answered by the question, what is the 39 steps? What are the 39 steps? And that's what gets him killed. So that's his secret in a way.
Oh, I thought the 39 steps was the spy network, not Mr. himself. So what he knows isn't what the spy network is. What he knows is what the spy network is trying to smuggle out of the country.
Mm-hmm. So it's basically like a double MacGuffin. Because you've got the phrase that's kind of introduced at the start, kind of like, oh, you know, Annabella says, oh, you know, the 39 steps, that sort of thing, which is a MacGuffin in itself. And then it leads into larger MacGuffin, which is like, okay, the 39 steps are, and then it's what is the whole purpose of it?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a box within a box sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Alice that to me the MacGuffin is the term that he's using, the secret ingredient for the plane, like, you know, so that's to me what the MacGuffin is, because at the end of it we don't doesn't mean anything to us what he's saying, but that's what he died for, that's what these people are looking for, and that's what this chase has begun with. But I do have a question about one of the things that I find very strange about this movie is Mr. Memory's response when Hannay shouts out, what are the 39 steps? Because he almost goes into this trance. Now, like, the 39 steps is a group of people, right? A secret organization. Uh-huh. But it's almost like this is his trigger code word as well to remember this. But in my opinion, the way they set up this character is that he shouldn't need that trigger because he's got all this stuff memorized anyways. So... As soon as Hannay asks, what are the 39 steps? Like, he almost glazes over when he starts reciting that information about
it. Yeah. A little Manchurian candidate.
Yeah. But, I thought the whole, his character was supposed to be, is like, it's a compulsion. He can't help but recite. If someone asks a question, because he's got this kind of incredible eidetic memory, it's just rote. And it's just kind of like, oh, if someone asks me a question, I'll just do it straight off the thing. I mean, I don't think he's really supposed to be a character. He could basically be a computer. He could be just like a stand-in. Yeah. But no, that's how I sort of interpreted it.
I think I've read Hitchcock saying that it's professional pride that undoes him. Because when he's asked the question, he cannot not answer it because that's his job. He's standing on a stage in front of an audience. So he would look foolish if he didn't answer the question.
It's basically like, at the end, shooting Google.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I feel like that, what you guys have just stated, is reinforced at the beginning, when they're at the music hall at the beginning, with his, am I right, sir? Mm-hmm. Am I right, sir? Mm. You know, he's so invested in knowing the stuff, as you guys have pointed out, that it's a point of professional pride that somebody's asked him what the 39 steps is, and he knows he shouldn't answer, but he just can't stop himself because he wants to prove that he knows.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of, like, there's the one question where somebody asks him the age of the woman, and he's like, I know it, but I'm not going to tell a woman's age. So,
yeah.
No, you're right. And the whole funny bit about Mae West's age, he's a gentleman, he wouldn't tell that. You know, there is all of that comedic stuff. So you're right. That does sort of throw a wrench in that theory. I agree.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, like, I'm probably looking way too deep into the film, but I've seen it so many times that watching it this time, I'm like, the glazing thing and, I like your answer, David, when you're like, it's professional pride and he can't not answer it because he's in front of a stage. I do like that, and that works for me, and that actually solves it for me. He's like, it's not glazed over. He's just like, I don't really want to be saying this, but I kind of have to because it's my job. I'm okay with that. Excellent. I tried to explain the MacGuffin to my wife, but she still didn't like it. She's like, I want to know what this means. And it's like, oh, I can't help you out, I guess. I don't know. So she did really enjoy the film, though. She'd never seen it before. So, and as I was mentioning to David ahead of time, I finally got to break open my Criterion Blu-ray. I bought it, I don't know, it came out, 5 years ago or something like that, and I finally got a chance to watch it. So,
well, I also, my last thing I would say about the MacGuffin in the not knowing is that that's almost like a, you know, it's a reveal at the end, right? If you knew that it was Mr. Memory with the information, it wouldn't be as interesting at the end when you realize... Right, because they don't ever tell you. Everyone thinks it's a piece of paper, a briefcase with some information in it. So it's a reveal at the end that you learn that it's Mr. Memory. So it would spoil it to have what the MacGuffin is be really obvious.
Yeah. And I love that reveal because I forgot about it. Again, it's been a while since I've seen it. I forgot that Mr. Memory was coming back at the end of the film. So when they realized that's how they were getting the information out, I'm like, that's brilliant. Like, that's really well written. I really like that a lot.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, for me personally, because, you know, the MacGuffin is one of my favorite kind of tropes in this sense, because it's both necessary and also doesn't really matter at the same time. So you've got, you know, the two examples I think of, so, and we were talking about this just before the episode started, but you guys were discussing kind of Mission Impossible movies and all that sort of thing, and, you know, in Mission Impossible 3, the big MacGuffin is the rabbit's foot. What is the rabbit's foot? We don't know. And there's even, like, a discussion about it, basically saying, why is this a MacGuffin? It's a MacGuffin because, you know, it could be anything. It could be a biological weapon. It could be, you know, all manner of things, that sort of thing. And it's never resolved at the end of the film. You see it in, like, a canister, and it's implied to be something about biological, but it never actually tells you what it is. Mm-hmm. But you can then look at, say, Touch of Evil in 1959, where it sort of inspired Tarantino's, you know, Pulp Fiction briefcase. Kind of, you open it and it's glowing and it's all that sort of thing, but you actually see ramifications of it.
Not Touch of Evil, Kiss Me Deadly.
Is it Kiss Me Deadly? Ah, wrong one. Yeah, thank you. I know, I was like, it's one of those, I know it.
So
Kiss Me Deadly, and it's the final scene where, you know, the villain opens it up and it's glowing and it's kind of, it's implied to be horrific, and then the house catches on fire and it's like a whole thing, and at least you sort of see, you can draw your own conclusion then. You know, you can go, okay, the 39 steps is da-da-da-da-da, or you can go, okay, the secret of this plane is da-da-da-da-da, but they're just different kinds of a trope, and there is variation in it, but it, you know, here it is the birth of it, and I think it's such a smart way to do it, because, you know, as you've said, it doesn't really matter to the characters. It's the thing driving them, but it means then you're more focused in, you know, in Richard and Pamela and kind of everyone else.
Now, I've got two books here that I refer to quite frequently when I am, when I'm doing this podcast here. The first one is The Art of Alfred Hitchcock by Donald Spotto, and the other one is Alfred Hitchcock, The Complete Films by Paul Duncan. And now both of these books refer to this as The 39 Steps is the first true masterpiece by Hitchcock. And I wanted to ask you guys about that because we're going through these films chronologically, and there's been, to me, a couple of masterpieces already. You know, like, I loved Blackmail and I loved Murder. And, you know, while I love this movie, I think I prefer The Man Who Knew Too Much, because going through them, it was such a shock to my system after those early British years and some of those not so good silent films that the Man Who Knew Too Much really had a big impact on me. Would you guys classify this as his first masterpiece? Alice, I'll start with you this time.
I don't know that I'm qualified to call anything a masterpiece. I haven't been going through them like you guys have. So, you know, a lot of his earlier silent stuff I've never seen. So I don't have much to compare it to. But I will say that I do think that it is a masterfully crafted story and sets up what I, as a consumer of pop culture movies, and even some highbrow movies every now and then, so much of it is recognizable, right? So much of it triggers my envisionment of things happening in other films and things being used in other films. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, to me, sure, it feels like a masterpiece because it feels like it's setting up the framework and structure for so many other things I've seen in movies.
Mm-hmm. David, what do you think? Do you think this is his first masterpiece?
I think a good case can be made for Blackmail, certainly, and The Lodger, certainly. So I'm not sure. And yes, in a way, that it's the Man Who Knew Too Much is really significant because it brings them together properly with Charles Bennett as a collaborator, and you can it's got the tone that you sort of expect to see from a Hitchcock light, one of his light thrillers. Mm-hmm. So that one is maybe more groundbreaking in a way. This one I like better than Man Who Knew Too Much, which I feel slightly struggles to keep focus who's the main character. And it's important for Hitchcock, it's important for most films to know who the main character is. Mm-hmm. But with Hitchcock, so many of his best effects are subjective. It really helps if you have a tight focus on one person. Mm-hmm. And that's almost the only thing he's taken from the book, is the idea that there's this guy, he's in trouble, he's got to solve a espionage plot line while being chased by the police. Mm-hmm. And everything else is more or less invented by Hitchcock and Bennett.
Okay.
But yeah, I think this is pure Hitchcock. It's stuff that he returned to almost obsessively. Mm-hmm. And it's a trial run, if you like, for North by Northwest in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, for North by Northwest. Like, I was totally thinking of North by Northwest the entire time I was watching this movie. I'm like, North by Northwest is basically a remake of this movie, is what it kind of feels like, you know? I realize there's enough differences, but, you know, with modern remakes, they're not always that close to the original, right? Like, they do differ drastically in that. Yeah. Like, if you look at Friday the 13th and then the remake of Friday the 13th, like, they're drastically different films, mm-hmm. right? But the tone and everything is the same, you know? Like, so North by Northwest could almost be a remake of this movie.
And Young and Innocent and what else? Apparently, Rebecca, he was going to rewrite and make it into a chase thriller. And he was told that he couldn't. That we've bought this novel and we're going to film it.
Oh, man, that would be way better than what we got. Whoops, did I say that aloud?
I'm not going to lie, I really want to see that version of Rebecca.
Yeah. Studios, take note.
Maxime de Winter on the run, I suppose. And then Foreign Correspondent and Sabotage. And yeah, it's obviously something he liked. And having discovered it here, I mean, that's what Hanny, the John Buchan novel, gave him. And it's kind of the only thing that he was able to really use from it. It's just that concept.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask Chris a question, then I'll come back to the novel there. Have you read the novel, David?
Yes, not recently.
I'll come back to that question then. So, Chris, what do you think? Is this the first masterpiece of Hitchcock's? What do you think?
I mean, I'm horribly biased because I love The Man Who Knew Too Much, as evidenced by the previous episode, where I just spent 40 minutes going how much I love this film. I think that it's certainly iconic, and it certainly has, you know, influenced thrillers and the spy genre, and kind of, you know, you can see its influence in dozens, if not hundreds, of films. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just, you know, okay, so we borrowed this thread or this plot point or this kind of thing from, you know, from the 39 Steps. I think it's iconic. I do think it's a masterpiece. I don't think it's his first one, because we do see, you know, like I said, Man Who Knew Too Much, which as much as I enjoyed 39 Steps, I still prefer Man Who Knew Too Much. For this, there's some parts of this that I'm like, oh, not so keen on it, but that's fine. Difference of opinion. Right. I think The Lodger's great. I think Blackmail was surprisingly good. I think we were going through a bit of a dearth of kind of like not great silent slash early talkies films. I was like, okay, Blackmail's fairly good. The Lodger's great and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, not his first, but it's definitely a masterpiece, and it definitely revolutionized kind of cinema. And it's great what David was saying, kind of like, oh, it's like a recurring, almost like an archetype, really, because you mentioned, Brendan, about kind of like the Hitchcock blonde and the fact that is set up here and it becomes a recurring kind of theme throughout and all that sort of thing. Whereas, you know, Man Who Knew Too Much obviously has its 1950s remake by Hitchcock again, and then, you know, a lot of the same characters get reused in different ways and with different faces, and a lot of it's telling the same story, you know, sometimes not even in a spy thriller context. So when you were mentioning, oh, The Innocent Man Who Gets Framed, it made me think of, I think it's 1978, Frenzy, which is about a serial killer in London who, halfway through, they arrest a particular character who isn't the killer, but who has been set up in the first half, so you think, oh, he might be the killer, he might be the killer, and then it turns out he's not, and it does a complete reversal, and then it becomes very similar to, say, North by Northwest, or, like, Saboteur, or Young and Innocent, in that sense. So, yeah, it's just really funny, kind of, now we're going into his strongest period, and it builds and builds and builds, and we get these iconic films, just how much of these patterns are being set up early. And how many kind of then decide to recur? It's a bit like there's a great YouTube channel called Screen Prism, and it's run by these fantastic editors and everything. And they do a series which is like, you know, it's a blank film when, and they've done like Tarantino, Christopher Nolan, Steven Soderbergh, all that sort of thing. And it's just kind of like they do a list, and it's like these recurring things that tend to pop up in films. I'm like, this is the kind of things we see with Hitchcock. You know, we see these kind of archetypes, we see these storylines, we see these sort of things, but he manages to keep making them interesting and fun and, you know, genuinely exciting.
Excellent. Yeah, so David, asking about the book here, one of the problems that I had with the movie on this rewatch is it really feels like the entire concept of the film was Hitchcock and Bennett sat down and said, I want a film where a man and a woman are handcuffed and on the run. Go. And I wanted to ask, is that in the book? Because it really feels like that's the genesis of the film, and they wrote it from there.
I don't think it's in the book. I don't think she's in the book. I don't think there's a romance. Yeah, because he's on the run, but he's the first person narrator, so you have access to his thoughts, so he can tell you what's happening. He doesn't need dialogue. Whereas Hitchcock knew that if you're going to spend the entire film with a man on the run, he'd better have somebody with him so that you can find out what he's thinking, unless he's going to talk to himself. So in a way, the invention of a leading lady is it's a movie convention that there should be a girl in the picture. And it's also necessary to, you know, like Doctor Who's companions, if your hero is going to do something smart, it's helpful to have somebody you can explain it to. If he worried about what he's going to do next, it's helpful to have somebody you can discuss it with. And if he's, and also you can use her to drag him down and create problems for him. And it's one of the good uses of the leading lady in the movie is to make her a problem for the hero. Mm-hmm. She becomes a difficulty to be overcome. And then by the end, she's his ally and they've become a team. It winds up being quite sweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like I've mentioned in the past, like screwball comedies aren't really my thing, right? So the screwball comedy part of this film is what brings it down in my personal rankings, right? I mean, the film's a masterpiece, but it's just like that, cause it's not really quite there until they're handcuffed together, and then it really kind of goes screwball comedy. So, Alice, what do you think of the screwball comedy aspect of it and them being handcuffed together?
So I would say I'm your antithesis, that I love screwball comedies.
Great. That's awesome. Yes.
And so that, you know, the witty repartee and how quickly they respond to each other and how she, you know, unlike the farmer's wife, is like, oh, hell no. And there's that back and forth. That for me actually lifts the movie up and takes it from just being sort of a boring three Keystone cop chase movie to having something to make me laugh and you know, have some fun with.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Chris, what do you think of the screwball parts of it?
Well, I'm kind of with Alice in that I kind of love a screwball cop. And I kind of wish that we would have more, like really well more done of them in the kind of modern cinema.
Yeah, I agree.
I enjoyed it. And it's weird, you know, we talked about this kind of thing recurring, but the idea of like, oh, well, the hero drags an unwilling female and into the thing and they end up falling in love, that sort of thing. But that kind of thing, weirdly, I've seen it. The other one I can think of is the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Running Man. Mm-hmm. It's literally the same. In the, she's just innocent, and that's the thing. And it's the same in the book, where it's like, oh yeah, no, you innocent person, I'm going to help with, you know. Actually, he does it in another film. He does it in Commando as well. Sorry, I didn't think I was going to talk about Schwarzenegger. But
so Schwarzenegger is the modern day Hanny.
Duh, because that exists in a universe out there somewhere. That exists. The 1980s remake. But no, so I enjoy it. The only part I found a bit distasteful, and it gets resolved when Richard and Pamela start developing their relationship and all that sort of thing, but it's when he sort of threatens her a bit, and it kind of comes out of nowhere, and he starts like physically shoving her and all that sort of thing, and I was a bit icked out by it. I don't know the way to describe it. I was just a bit, oh, okay, I'm supposed to be rooting for you as a hero. Maybe, you know, don't start shoving this person who did not ask to get involved. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's fine because they do end up having like a sort of chemistry and it's fine. But it does lighten it up, but it is like they've dropped kind of like it happened one night and gone here into a thriller. Go, you know, and the end shot is kind of them. They've still got the handcuffs on and they're holding hands and it's kind of a sweet moment and everything. Are they amongst my favourite Hitchcock couples? No, I have some who I'm like, oh, okay. They have like a, you know, a better relationship, or kind of they spend more time building it and all that sort of thing. But it's very similar to say, you know, it's literally North by Northwest. It's literally James Stewart and Eva St. Marie, isn't it? It's literally the same. You know, thorny relationship, same in, you know, James Stewart and Grace Kelly in Rear Window. And, you know, there's never any just like, they start off being normal and happy and healthy, and they just move through it, really. Apart from The Man Who Knew Too Much, both versions of it. So it's kind of interesting to see. I enjoyed it, though. I thought it made it more fun than it might not otherwise have been.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It's kind of a road movie trope, isn't it? That you put a couple of them together, and they don't get on. You can do it with two guys, you can do it with two girls, or you can do it with a romantic couple. First of all, they have to not get on because that will be the story. There's the journey of where they're going to, and then there's the journey of the relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's the sure thing, or any one of those movies where two people go somewhere. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. This is basically Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, only with more spying.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I really liked about this is, you know, like we talk about this and we understand that these movies are of a time and things are different now than they were then. But unfortunately, we do have this filter of modern day life that we do have to look through, right? And, you know, especially with the era of the Me Too movement that's going on right now, we look at how he's introduced to her on the train, right? And how he kisses her on the train and whatnot. And one of the things that I really liked about this introduction is it kind of turns it on its head. And I think the reason it turned it on its head for me is because I recently watched North by Northwest. And in North by Northwest, you know, Eve Marie Saint goes to bat for him and says, oh, you know, denies knowing him and hiding him and whatnot. And you're expecting her to give him up, but she doesn't. And in this one, she gives him up right away. She's like, this is the man you're looking for. And I like that because it's honestly, it's not what you're expecting. You're kind of expecting the leading man to charm her right away, you know? Uh-huh. So I wanted to ask you guys about that and what you think. And Alice, we'll go with you first.
Sure. So yes, as a lady person, I'd like to state that I'm very happy to hear that grosses you out. So I do. I think that's one of the things for a modern female audience, at least initially when you meet the lead female, that she is savvy and smart and isn't just going to be charmed by this good looking guy, that she's immediately like, oh no. But I also think from a writing perspective, it's interesting because you get Annabelle Smith at the beginning saying like, oh, I'm not going to go to the police, right? Because they're never going to believe me. Mm-hmm. Just like you don't believe me, then something happens to make him believe her. Mm-hmm. So then we go to the milkman who doesn't believe him when he tells him the truth. So he lies to him. So then we're on the train. She doesn't believe him. Then we go to the woman in the farmland. She does believe him. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's all of this back and forth between who's going to believe this tale of the spy and who's not going to believe him, mm-hmm. and what has to happen to make that person believe the story. So in that sense, it doesn't bother me when the two leads get together, because I like his play where she's like, okay, well, you're not going to believe me. Your other option is to believe that I'm a murderer. And okay, let's go down that road. Right. And so it works for me in that sense, and seeing him, you know, do that switch where I know in my heart he's really not that guy, works for me because it's convincing her and moving the plot along in the direction that we need it to move.
Yeah, David, what do you think about the leading lady not quite believing him at the beginning and turning him in?
I think it's cute because it's the unexpected way to go. Mm-hmm. The other nice thing is that almost the first person to, you know, it's a relief when he meets a man who finally does believe in who is the villain. it's constructed around a series of nice reversals. So every time you're in a situation where you can expect it to go one way, they'll find a logical reason for it to go another way. And I wonder to what extent they plotted this on the hoof and sort of made script sessions sort of telling each other the story and making it up as they went along, mm-hmm. trying to get themselves into trouble and then trying to find ways out of it.
Yeah.
It feels like it has a nice looseness to it where they would be throwing situations at each other and say, well, what if we have the bad guy just shoot him dead? Mm-hmm. And then, okay, well, what do we do now? Oh, well, we'll go back and it'll turn out that he's got a prayer book in his pocket.
Yes.
You know, this stuff is feels like, you know, we've written ourselves into an impossible situation.
That totally had my wife. When he got shot, my wife was like, what? Like, she totally was not expecting it, right? Because she's never seen it before. She's like, what? And then the reveal happens a little bit later. So, you know, I thought that was good. Like, I've seen it so many times. I don't remember how I first reacted when I saw the movie, right? So, But with what you're mentioning there, though, even with the cops, because then the cop, when he goes and turns himself in, and the cop's like, oh, yeah, I totally believe you. Let's get this all taken care of. What, you didn't really think I believe you, do you? You know, like, even there, we got a whole nother example of the expectations being turned on their head. And that happens so many times in this movie. Like, it really is a whirlwind. Like, I really do love this movie. I think it's a fantastic movie. It's great, you know. So it is a really wonderful film.
Come on. You know, I find these hymns pretty hard to get through myself. I mean, that bit in the cop station is hilarious.
Yes, it is.
It's hilarious.
That guy's worth, that's worth, he merits a shout out. Frank Sellier. who's also in The Passing of the Third Floor Back, a movie co-written by Alma Revel.
Okay.
Starring Conrad Veidt as a man who is basically Jesus, who moves into an English lodging house in London. And Frank Sellier plays an evil businessman who's basically Satan. It's an allegory set in a suburban London lodging house. Fits nicely with Hitchcock's Catholic interests. And it's one of the few Alma films away from Hitchcock where you can kind of see a Hitchcockian concern, maybe. But Sellier is a fabulous fleshy actor who's got a seems to be able to do anything, but he's good at sort of corrupt, nasty pieces of work. The another thing that's very Hitchcock is the scene where we meet the bad guy is almost exactly like meeting James Mason in North by Northwest.
Yep.
But even down to the fact that he's interrupted by his wife, and he has a very normal, innocent-seeming wife. So that's something Hitchcock goes back to again and again. The idea you'll have a master criminal, but he's also got a social life, he's got family, he's surrounded by the same normal things that we all are. And that just makes him seem worse in a way, but it also makes him seem real.
Makes it right. Well, before I'm going to open up to you guys to see if there's anything else we missed. There's one last thing that I want to talk about. I want to talk about the fact that they mentioned Canada in this, because I'm from Canada, and they never mention Canada enough in movies. And so I've been holding onto this one all day here, waiting to use this in this podcast. But I love it here because this movie, we've totally got the hoser on the Highlands. Right? So I love it. I think it's, you know, I love that it's Canadian. I love that the first question he asks is, how far is Winnipeg from Montreal? Because these are cities in my country. And, like, you know, it with American cinema, you know, Canada is like never mentioned. You always see these crazy places across the planet, and like Canada is always forgotten. So I love representation of Canada on screen, and it's even crazier to see it in a black and white movie from the 30s. But I think it's absolutely fantastic.
I have a theory about it, which is they mustn't have known that they were going to get Robert Donat, so they thought we're going to try and get an American to play this part. But we'll call him a Canadian in order to be able to more readily explain why he's in London. Mm-hmm. Because you see that in a lot of British films of the period. You've got American actors, usually sort of failing American actors who've been stars but are on the way out. And they can afford to get them for British pictures. And then they make them Canadian to sort of explain, how can he be an army officer, a British army officer, if he's played by an American actor? Oh, well, he's Canadian.
I gotta watch more British pictures.
I think they didn't know they were going to get Donut, and then at that point it was no longer really necessary for him to be Canadian, but they kept it. Mm-hmm. I was interestingly just watched a movie called The Feminine Touch last night, which is a 50s British movie about nursing. Mm-hmm. And one of the major plot points is about whether the nurse heroine will leave her job and marry a doctor who's moving to Saskatchewan. And the happy ending is they go to Saskatchewan.
Yes, that's a happy ending for all.
Yep. So you should definitely see that one. It's got major Canadian references.
Well, the last time it really stuck out to me was with Fiend Without a Face. Like, there's that air base in Manitoba, you know? Like, it's just, right, that's at the start of the movie, and it's like, it takes place in Manitoba, and it's like, I love this. They need to do this more. So... Anyways, right on. Okay, so I'm going to go around the table one last time here. I'm going to ask you your final thoughts, and please bring up any other topics that I haven't brought up yet, because this movie's so rich. There's so much to talk about that we could talk about it for another hour. But, you know, we do got to wrap the conversation up at some point. But, so if there's anything that I haven't quite mentioned that you want to talk about, please mention it again. Alice, we'll start with you.
Sure. I really enjoy how tightly written, even if it was loosely. And there are so many things that tie back together throughout the film. You know, later in the film, they'll reference back to something that happened before. And I just think it's beautifully done in this film. I do have a question for you, David, which is Killin, right? So when she shows her the map of Scotland and you've got the town, and in big letters it says Killin, which I thought, I don't know if that was on purpose or mistake or planned, but is there a place called Killin in Scotland?
I'm just Googling it.
Okay.
it's not implausible, because certainly there's lots of Scottish place names that begin with Kill. Kilmarnock and so on. I've got Killingworth in Newcastle.
Well, I listened to the commentary as well on the Blu-ray, which I've heard before because I had the DVD as well. But Marion Keane, she does actually make reference to that, and she thinks it's a Hitchcock joke to have the word "killing" so abrupt in the middle. Like it's probably is a real place, but it's Hitchcock's humor that he put that so right and centered.
I'm looking at on the map right now, and it's up north. It's Loch Lomond area.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if it's big enough that you would necessarily. It would show up on a map.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seems like you want.
It is a real place.
You want a place in that part of the world that has a sinister sign to it. That's quite a good one.
There you go. Yeah, it's so, like every 20 minutes in this movie, there's been that build to something big happening, and then there's a moment of pause. 20 minutes in, pause. 20 more minutes, pause. 20 more minutes. It's, it's got that tension. It's hilarious. When they run into the sheep and he's like, oh, it's a flock of detectives. There's just so many funny bits, as well as the tension. And I'm a clothing nerd. My mother was a professional costumer, and I love films from this period because the clothing I just wish people still dressed that way today because the clothes are amazing. The whole bit when she's having to take off her wet stockings, the only thing I could fault this film for in my mind is there's when they after they he escapes from the fourth bridge. They stay on that picture of the fourth bridge for what feels like forever to me, where they're doing the little newscasting about how he's escaped and he might have gotten a change of clothing. I just am looking at that fourth bridge going like, okay, let's I've had enough of the fourth bridge. But I really, really enjoy this film. By far my favorite Hitchcock film.
And what would you give it out of 5? And we kind of do funny ratings here too. So just on the 6.
Oh, okay. I will give it 4.7 wet stockings out of 5.
Excellent, right on. David, did you have any final thoughts on the film, and did you want to give it a rating?
I suppose I should talk about Scottishness and then the fun elements for me.
No, we're just going to keep talking about Canada.
Did you guys notice what movie is being advertised in the train station in Edinburgh?
No.
It's The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Oh, nice.
There's a poster for that.
Looking back on that, that's so cool.
It's cute that as an early example of the MacGuffin, Hitchcock got the name MacGuffin from a joke about traveling salesmen, and the MacGuffin is a device for catching lions in the Scottish Highlands. Mm-hmm. And this movie has two traveling salesmen in it, and they go to the Highlands. So it seems like this must be the first time he was really seriously thinking about what the MacGuffin is and what you could do with it, and that joke seems to tie in with things in this movie. I should mention John Laurie, the crofter, the nasty Highlander with the sympathetic wife. He's an axiom of Scottish film and television. He's in an early Michael Pyle film, Edge of the World, and then in the 60s and 70s, he was in Dad's Army, a very popular sitcom here. With the catchphrase, "We're all doomed." So he was the classic gloomy Scotsman. What else? I guess one reason they might linger on the fourth bridge for so long is just to try and stop us worrying too much about how Annie, having climbed off the train, is going to cover the next 100 miles and wind up in the Highlands.
Good point.
Because it's a fair distance. So maybe it's just we'll keep them thinking about the news broadcast, and okay, he might have changed his clothes, and then the next time you see him, he's trudging over the mountains. What else would I want to say? Hands are really important in this film. I made a little video essay, which is now lost, where I just cut together all the close-ups of hands. Mm-hmm. Hanny is introduced buying a ticket for the music hall, so we see his hand first, then he gets handcuffed to a girl. The villain has a missing finger. Even though it's called Steps, it's maybe more about hands, and the close-up of the hands holding at the end is a really nice touch. Yeah, as you're saying, it feels loose in that you don't know what's going to happen next, and you kind of guess that maybe they didn't know, but they've worked hard at coming up with answers. But tight in that every solution they come up with to their problems is just absolutely right, and the way it spirals back to the starting point, so we back to the music hall for the ending, just gives it a feeling of perfect perfection and completion. Mm-hmm. So I would give it close to 5 out of 5 because I can't think of a way that I would want it or need it to be any better in any aspect. It may not be perfect, mm-hmm. but I don't think it has any faults that bother me. Mm-hmm. I just love every aspect of it.
I guess we should ask you here, like, because a lot of this film was done on sets, right? Because that's how Hitchcock liked to work. But how did this look like Scotland? I've never been, so like,
it looks like a studio rendition of Scotland. It's no more or less convincing than Brigadoon or other reconstructed Scotland. The Forth Bridge stuff is they've obviously got some real background plates of the Forth Bridge, and then it's all shot against mm-hmm. a rear projection screen in the studio. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the only actual Scottish footage in it, I suspect. And I guess they sent some people into the hills to get some wide shots of a stand-in mm-hmm. pretending to be Hanny walking in long shot. So there's a few location shots. Nice. That are definitely Scotland, and then one or two that are probably Scotland but probably not as far north as they're pretending. But I don't find it embarrassing or problematic or unbelievable. And they do have like their one Scottish actor, John Laurie, in order to have an accent.
Yes, to keep it authentic.
Everybody else we meet in Scotland is English. But doesn't bother me hugely.
Excellent, right on.
Nobody does a sort of groundskeeper Wally or a Scotty type. Nobody does a James Doohan accent. So they just don't, like Frank Sellier is presumably should be Scottish, and he's barely even trying, and it's better than doing.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Chris. Did you have any final thoughts on the film, and what would you give a rating?
I really enjoyed this film. I hadn't seen it before we did this, even though I'd heard a lot about it, and it's one of my dad's favourite films, and one he's excited to kind of rewatch and everything. Just coming back to a couple of points ago, and it is only a tiny point, but when you were saying, the fact that, that Pamela instantly gave him up, I loved her for that. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a great moment, because I was like, I love this girl now. Because she's the kind of, you'd just be like, yeah, okay, she's smart. She's instantly going like, no, I'm not just going to believe you. Oh, the police looking for me, but I'm innocent. Really? Really? And I was instantly won by that, and I thought, yeah. And I did start to believe in them as a couple and everything. But no, I honestly really enjoyed it. It's a fantastic thriller. It is a great character piece in a way, and it does kind of, once those two kind of link up, it does become a nice relationship, and it does become kind of this template for the kind of spiky dynamic that Hitchcock always liked to talk about. So yeah, I just really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. If I had to give it a rating, I would go 4.5 wounded, soon to be dead secret agents who turn up at your door telling you about the 39 steps.
Excellent.
I don't know where the half comes from, but that's
excellent.
Super wounded.
Well, I've said just about everything that I want to say on the movie. It was really good. It was a lot of fun. I'm going to give it the rating. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 handcuffs. And, I like the movie a lot. I've got my Letterboxd list. So, listeners, if you're not following me on Letterboxd, you can find me at Brandon Metella on Letterboxd. I've got a list and I'm ranking. So out of the 19 that we've watched so far for Hitchcock, because I've got Elstree Calling and Mary in here in my list, I have this ranked as 5th, so it's in my top 5, but I will list my top 5 here. So Murder is my favorite so far. I really loved Murder, and I really love Blackmail. Blackmail is my 2nd, followed by The Lodger, followed by The Man Who Knew Too Much, followed by The 39 Steps. So those are my top 5 Hitchcock films so far. So excellent. David, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you, where they can get some information on you? You on Twitter, you on Facebook?
I'm on Twitter as D. Cairns. I run a blog called Shadowplay, which is dcairns.wordpress.com, which is daily updates, all kinds of movie stuff. And recently, with my wife, started a podcast called The Shadowcast, which you can find via the blog, I guess. It's on iTunes, it's on Libsyn, it's And you can find it via the Twitter account, I think, where we talk about three different movies each time that are related movies, but sort of contrasting as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we discuss them with our cat.
Excellent. Now, the Blu-ray of this came out in 2012, and in the list here of your credits, it says that you were working on a documentary about French cinema. Did you finish that?
Yes, that's called Nathan or Nathan. And it's a strange and tragic tale of the most important French film producer of the 30s and how he was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And that can be bought from French Amazon on DVD, mm-hmm. If you want to see that one. And it's a very odd tale of tragic injustice. A man who owned the biggest studio in France discovered Jean Gabin and introduced widescreen and Technicolor to French cinema decades before it was sound, and is remembered today most often, if he's remembered at all, for something he never did, which is have sex with a duck on screen.
That's funny to be remembered by something that could be so easily disproved.
Yeah, I mean, especially since that piece of film exists and photographs of him exist, and clearly a different bloke.
It ain't him. I'm saying this, but how many people a few years ago believed that Leonardo DiCaprio had sex with that bear in The Revenant?
Probably a few. Yeah,
I was gonna say there was that big. Big rumor. It was like, oh my god, what did you do to the bear? I'm like, I know he wants an Oscar. He obviously didn't have sex with a bear.
Alice, where can people find you online?
If you're going to search a social network for me, it will be under ALCBKR. I did a podcast called Educating Geeks for about 4 years, and its archive is available on Libsyn. Currently, I have two podcasts that I'm working on. One is with my elder sister, Anne, and we're reading through all of the Hugo and Nebula award-winning novels. Mm. We've just gotten to the 60s, thank God, and I can't wait until we get to the 70s. And then I'm also working on a movie pitch podcast, which is sort of a comedy podcast, but that's still very much in development.
Your Nebula and Hugo award-winning one sounds a lot like me during the early days of Hitchcock when we're going through the silent films, and I'm like, thank God we've made it to the sound films. Thank God we've made it to the man who knew too much.
Let's be honest, sometimes it was literally just like, how many more of these have we got to go? Five. Damn it.
I think all the British ones you have lined up next are all, if not necessarily great, they've all got really good stuff in them, so you're going to have it plain sailing from here on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Chris, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy, in which I generally talk about various random stuff I like. There's not a lot of structure on there. I co-host a show with my best mate Emma Platt at North by Nerd West. It's a chance for us just to kind of catch up, hang out. We talk about all kinds of geeky pop culture stuff and also touch on kind of social issues and that sort of thing. We've taken a break for a bit this year, but hopefully we're going to get some new episodes out in the new year. Aside from that, I also appear kind of sporadically on a podcast called Eccentric Earth, which is amazing. And it's my mate Amy Walker's podcast in which... And I love this format. She basically invites you on, tells you she's going to teach you about a historical topic, and then doesn't tell you what it's going to be before the episode starts. So I have no idea. The only way, because I've covered some weird stuff, I've covered real lighthearted stuff, all the way up to like massacres. And so she kind of now has like a color rating system going like, yeah, this is going to be quite dark. Are you okay with it? I'm like, I can handle dark stuff. It's fine. And then I come out of it 2 hours later, just kind of needing to watch like a Studio Ghibli movie and just be wrapped up in blankets and just like go to a happy place. But the podcast itself is fantastic. There is a 50th episode special coming up really soon that I think is going to be absolutely fantastic. So please check that out on all major podcast providers.
Excellent. And I won't go over all my old stuff here, but I'll talk about the new stuff. So you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. And me and three friends of mine are launching a podcasting network. And as of the release of this episode, it is launched. So it's called the United Federation of Podcasts. And we currently have three shows on there. And my show that I'm hosting with my good friend Zach Moore is inspired by our Halloween podcast that we did last summer, where we covered all of the Halloween films. And the podcast is called Franchise Fatigue, and in this podcast yeah, we love it because we love sequels and we love remakes, so we pick a series of movies and we're going to cover all of them and we're going to talk about them all because we love sequels and we love remakes. And we had a heck of a lot of fun doing the Halloween ones, so if you follow along as of the release of this, the first three episodes should be available, and which is our episode zero, our launch episode, plus the first two Mission Impossible films. That's where we're starting, is Mission Impossible. And we're planning on, after Mission Impossible, we're going to do Pet Sematary, because there's the first two, and the remake is coming out soon. And I think we're going to try and hit up Jaws, Toy Story, and the Terminator movies. And that should be our first year's worth of stuff. So thank you so much to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting us. You can find us on their master feed. You can also find us in our own independent podcast feed. Just search Good Evening wherever podcasts are found. And don't forget to look as well and listen to our good friends Annie and Catherine and their podcast, Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, where they go over all the episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. It's a lot of fun, and I like listening to them every week and watching the Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes. And a big thank you to our friend Jason Cullimore for composing our wonderful theme. You can find his website, jasoncullimore.com. And our good friend Tom, who's away this week, you can find him on Twitter, at TomCaldwell3000. And he's on Instagram at the Tom Caldwell, where he has pictures of his dog, as he likes to tell us. So excellent. Until next time, when we cover Secret Agent, I believe is the next one. Secret Agent. We should have a special guest for that one as well, but I don't want to say it yet, just in case. But we should have another special guest on that one.
There. It's a secret.
And he's a secret agent. Yes. Excellent. So until next time, when we cover Secret Agent, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.